we saw in the private sector with nonprofits that paint the broken veteran narrative, elicit sympathy and pity to raise money. And we just got sick and tired of it. I got sick and tired of it. And I think this is the greatest threat to the veteran community and our families, is the broken veteran narrative. So we started Zero Mills because we also got sick of nonprofits competing with each other and not working together to create greater change.
Welcome to the Tango Tango podcast. Real, raw, and unfiltered conversations with veterans and those who support them. Tune in, be inspired, and walk away stronger.
Welcome to Top Talks. First Sergeant talks with real veterans with real stories, unedited and unscripted. And today we have something rare. We have somebody who connects the dots better than I do, and somebody who's very connected, a Marine Corps veteran, a founder of a bunch of different things, which we're going to talk about, Marine Corps son, Marine Corps retired lieutenant colonel, and no better friend to veterans out there. Welcome to Tango Tango, Kevin.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Lloyd. It's great to be here on a cold Thursday in Iron Mountain, Michigan.
Yeah, so Iron Mountain, Michigan. We were just talking. He said he had a couple inches of ice, and you can't see it right now, but I'm in short pants. It's 85 degrees in the hot Atlanta. So we'll get to the story how you ended up in Iron Mountain, Michigan, and soon to be Wisconsin. But let's take it all the way back to your childhood. Your dad is a Marine veteran. So what, enlisted officer, and what was it like to grow up in a Marine family, Kevin?
Yeah, my dad served in the 60s. So he's a Vietnam-era veteran, went to Hofstra University and went through the PLS program. So didn't have a scholarship. One day decided as a junior in college that he wanted to be a Marine. His dad was in the Army Air Corps, emigrated from Germany in 1919 as a teenager, and in 1929 joined the Army and served for almost 30 years, retired as a master sergeant in the Army Air Corps. I grew up in Toms River, New Jersey, one of six kids. I don't know, but I think the biggest reason I became a Marine myself was not because my dad encouraged me. I think it's quite the contrary. I think selfishly as fathers, my son is a Marine too, my son Carl, so we have three generations, but my dad never said, hey, I want you to be a Marine. But I noticed whenever he would be on the phone with one of the Marines he served with in the 60s, or a friend of his named Marty Brennan, who was a Bronze Star recipient in Vietnam, my dad would be a different person. He would just light up. And I think that just by osmosis, I realized that really helped him get to the point in his life where he was a leader. The other thing is, in the Easter season, I think it's appropriate to mention my mother. I grew up in a big Catholic family. She instilled in me the value of service, treating my neighbors the way I'd want to be treated, serving other people, the golden rules, right? And growing up as an altar boy in the Catholic Church, volunteering at the community at food banks, I think my mother had just as much to do in inspiring me to serve as my dad
did. That's awesome. So, and you definitely have lived a life of service in and out of uniform. But what did your childhood look like? I mean, were you in Toms River? Were you out at the beach? Were you playing ones?
Oh yeah.
Were you into sports, or was it all that?
No, I was a big surfer. And I played tennis and I wrestled in high school. So kind of a jack of all trades. I think growing up, I went to high school from 1981 to 1985. It was a time of in America where you played all sports. You really didn't specialize in one sport or the other. So I was out there every season, basketball, football, baseball, playing in an empty lot near my house growing up. And, you know, even today when I play sports with my kids, I can do just about anything. So I think we had a very balanced childhood. It was a little bit crazy. Having five brothers and sisters is a little bit manic. There's 23 years between the oldest and the youngest. So we always had a full house of kids, and I think it was a great life. I always look back at it fondly. I was just back there seeing my mom and dad and some of my brothers and sisters a couple of weeks ago.
Nice. So we're about the same age. I graduated high school in 1987. I wrestled as well. What weight class did you wrestle?
Well, they made me wrestle at 129 first 3 years, and then I wrestled at 149.
Wow. So I was 6 foot tall. I'm a little taller now, but I wrestled 138. So I was the skinny, lanky guy, but I was losing a bunch of weight because I couldn't handle the upper weight classes. So what did, you know, I think wrestling develops more character than any other sports because it's supposedly a team sport. But when you're, as I always said, when I was laying on my back counting the lights, you know, you have no one to blame but yourself.
I think it's one of those character builders that you never forget. Just the discipline around it. I also had an experience in college where I boxed, which I actually think boxing is a much more difficult sport. Again, you're out there by yourself for, in that case, three rounds, and you're sparring generally against people who are pretty good at what they do. And it was a good preparation for the Marine Corps, I think, in both cases.
So the let's say go into your Marine Corps. So you graduated high school and where'd you go to college at?
I went to a small Jesuit college called the College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts. Okay. About 3,000 students at the most. I studied English literature and I had a scholarship through the ROTC program. It's a funny story, actually. I went to, well, to see the recruiter, and in where I grew up in Toms River, they all share an office. So that day, the Marine officer who was responsible for the ROTC program wasn't there, and the Navy officer was. And I actually signed up for the scholarship, and he convinced me that, no, you just sign up for the Navy scholarship, then you become a Marine later, when that's not actually the process. So I went to Holy Cross, and it was on a Navy ROTC scholarship, but you have to declare as a Marine option. So I had to go through a selection process again my freshman year at Holy Cross. Had a really successful time. I was a drill team captain. I wound up being the XO of the battalion there. And I was actually commissioned, believe it or not, by then Major Joe Dunford, who became our commandant and also became the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The same story, I'll share one quick story. My dad and mom came up with my grandparents, and my dad administered the oath. Well, about two sentences in, he literally broke down and cried like a baby. And General Dunford said, "Mr. Schmiegel, I got this, sir." And he, you know, Major Dunford raised his right hand and he read me, administered the oath to me. He didn't read it. He knew it, obviously knew it cold. And the last part of the story is when my son went to boot camp at Parris Island in 2014, I'm just sitting in the audience and you see thousands of Marines raising their right hand and they're administering the oath to them. And just like my dad cried, like you watch your son and you have this completely emotional experience, which I never thought I would do. I'm a retired colonel. I've seen enlistment ceremonies over and over again, but when it's your own son, it's a little bit different.
I cried like a baby at my retirement ceremony, talking about my late wife and my kids and everything they sacrificed. And one of my favorite pictures I have is my late wife and me with a chairman, Joint Chief of Staff Dunford. Maybe 5 or 6 years ago, I guess.
What a great leader.
Yeah, absolutely.
He was incredible.
So you decide to join the Marines. So it's not a shock to anybody. It was your trajectory. You're planning for it. Although with an English degree, I think you probably should have gone in the Air Force, but that's okay. So you become an artillery officer. Was that by choice or was that something that was selected for you?
Yeah, it was actually by choice. I remember at the basic school doing a call for fire, a very small range with these pneumatic mortars, watching stuff blow up. I thought that was kind of cool. In the Marine Corps, we have something called the basic school, and they actually divide you up in thirds. And everything you do is measured. Everything. You know, written test, land nav, firing the rifle, the pistol, patrolling, leadership. Everything you do. And then they rank you and they call it quality spread. So the person who finishes number one, number 71, and number 141 pick in that order. Then number two, number 72, number 142. So they divide it in thirds so that there's a quality spread across military occupational specialties. I finished in the top third and I was the first person to pick artillery. So then I became the class leader at Fort Sill when we went the basic artillery school.
Yeah, very cool. I spent some time in Fort Sill and actually more time in Altus Air Force Base. We used to go to Fort Sill for fun. That's how bad.
Oh, really? Well, we used to go to Dallas for fun, Lloyd. We used to go down to Dallas.
I was a poor airman basic in flight school. I couldn't afford Dallas. So what was your first assignment, Kevin?
My first assignment was at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. I showed up probably in August, early August, and by December we were deploying in support of Operation Desert Shield and Desert Storm. So I had three really great jobs. I was the fire direction officer. So in my opinion, during a time of war in the firing battery for a young lieutenant, being the fire direction officer was kind of, in my mind, the best job you could have. I was the headquarters platoon commander, responsible for 60 Marines. We were doing split battery ops. So there's 120 Marines in Echo Battery, 2nd Battalion, 10th Marines. But here's the hardest job I had. I was the embarkation officer for my battery. So I arrive in August, we get the call, and I have to literally box up the entire artillery battery on top of being a headquarters battery commander or headquarters platoon commander and also being responsible for the FDC. So it was a pretty trying time.
Did you fly or did you go by ship?
No, we flew over. We flew through Shannon and back through Shannon. You know, that last Guinness before you have to go downrange. And we showed up in our green camis. We went to the base camp in Saudi Arabia. And a bunch of my friends who were from Camp Pendleton, they were all in their desert camis. We looked so green, literally green, until we got the full issue. But you know what's funny? The one thing I remember about being there the first time was how cold I was. Like, I could not ever get warm because you would have these, you know, 70, 80 degree days, and then it would drop, you know, 20, 30 degrees at night in the desert. And we didn't have the same gear. There was no Gore-Tex, right? We just had
the gear.
Everything was
hot. The gear is much better now.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I remember being cold in the desert. I tell a story, the coldest I've ever was. I was an aircraft loadmaster, and then I was in a mobile command and control unit. And one time I was working in Mombasa, Kenya, and it was an 80 degree day. And I was supervising downloading of a commercial airplane, and it was pouring the heaviest rain I've ever seen. And I swear I got hypothermia on an 80 degree day. Because it was just wet and windy.
I can see that. Yeah. I went to Mombasa too when I was with NATO and U.S. European Command. And it's actually the sickest I ever got. I think it's partly because of the change in weather. And your body just has to adjust to those climates all the time.
So being a crew member, I was always adjusting to the climate, you know, and everything like that. So let's get into your Desert Storm. I mean, what did that look like? Were you at a base your whole time, or did you actually were you mobile and saw action?
Yeah, we were mobile. We were in direct support of 6th Marines, another 2nd Marine Division unit. We were actually right on the border, or at least the area of responsibility with an Army unit and a British unit. I mean, it was a very chaotic space, a very big space. We had to go through the minefield in MOP 4.
In MOP 4?
I was up for 72 hours for loading targets into the BCS, the system we used to target different high-value targets. And we had hundreds of them to put in. So I was literally like falling asleep as we were going through the breach. And it went very fast. We were very effective at what we did. We were very well-trained. And it wasn't nearly as bad as we thought it was going to be. I mean, 4 days is not a long time. I think it was the wait afterwards that kind of really sucked the most. Like, and you know, the log train didn't keep up. I didn't have a shower at one point for 45 days, like no joke. And we got one, you know, two canteens of water. You were brushing your teeth and shaving with that. Those are true stories. And there were people, I had Marines whose camis literally disintegrated on their legs by the time we burned them, right?
And that's a Marine Corps recruiting commercial right there.
It was not a pretty sight. And we were hot racking and sleeping bags, and it was not. But all in all, like if you think about being a young person and you feel almost immortal, it was scary, especially because of the nerve agents and the things that we were most concerned about. So at the end of the day, like we were welcomed home as heroes. Like there was a parade in Tom's. There were parades everywhere, right? For me, it was a little bit much to do about nothing. Like we did our job. We did it very well. We were very effective. And we were all worried about what could happen. None of it did. And we all made it home, right? It wasn't a high casualty war for us. Yeah, we saw some things that you would see in combat. Like all in all, it wasn't nearly like Iraq and Afghanistan and the post 9/11 conflicts.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember I spent a lot of time flying back and forth. It was challenging, but it's what we had been trained for. So we were equipped for. So you came home back to North Carolina, or did you have another assignment shortly after?
It's 35 years ago, yeah. And I was really, I loved being a Marine, a young lieutenant. So I immediately volunteered to be part of a Marine Expeditionary Unit and deploy again. I was actually the target information officer for MU, working directly under General, or then Colonel, Jim Jones, who became a commandant too. Yeah. I was a second lieutenant. He actually promoted me to first lieutenant, actually later promoted me to major and then lieutenant colonel. So had a really strong relationship, had a great time on MU. It wasn't like a deployment that you would normally see. We basically were responsible for the Mediterranean for 6 months in the Black Sea. And we stopped in Palma de Mallorca, Spain for Christmas, Camp de Canjores, France. We went to Monte Carlo. We went to Paris. So we would work hard in these training exercises. We went to Israel, trained with the Israelis in Haifa, but then we would get to enjoy, you know, time, liberty in all these great places, Italy, Greece, all over the place, even in the Black Sea. So that 6 months went very fast. I went back. I actually started training up for another deployment, and that one didn't happen. I was training to go to Mountain Leaders Course. You think about all the money that the military invests in young people. I talk about this all the time. Like, we are constantly seeking self-improvement, right? Because we're empowered through all these different trainings. Sort of, I jumped out of airplanes before I became a Marine when I was at Holy Cross. I consider that a life skill. Like, it wasn't like someone thinks about it, but think about the things you have to do in that three-week course down in Fort Benning. All those things contribute to your leadership and your ability to adapt and overcome things. So I had a great first tour, and then I got stationed in London, believe it or not, London, England after that.
As an artillery guy in London?
Yeah. So it's kind of a funny story too. I got to the end of my 3 years. I had met a young English girl on deployment in the Mediterranean. She was in Spain on vacation and we kept in contact. I visited there. She visited North Carolina, which was a complete culture shock for her. And then I requested orders to London. You get to pick three things. And I was one of 161 first lieutenants that put that as their first choice. And I got selected largely because my battery commander at the time knew the detailer that literally horse traded for the job with the infantry monitor. And I wound up going. I was the first artillery officer to get that assignment. Usually went to an infantry officer.
And what was the actual assignment?
So I was the executive officer of the Marine Corps Security Force Company in London. So a lot of people don't know this, that the naval headquarters for Europe is actually in Naples, Italy now. It used to be in London. And we had 450 civilian employees. And there was a ready response force of 80 Marines that guarded the building just adjacent to the embassy. So I was the executive officer. And then for a time, I actually served as the commanding officer. It was a pretty good tour of duty. My first two sons were born there. So they're dual citizens. I love going back there. I'm not married to my ex-wife anymore. Obviously I'm married to Laura now, but we're still close and it was a great place to be assigned.
Yeah, very cool. And you later on went to do some NATO assignments?
Yeah, so I was fortunate to get my graduate degree. I got very involved in the manpower. I described my Marine time as a Marine in three parts. An artillery officer, somewhat of a subject matter expert in manpower. I did two tours there. And then I did two tours with a very high-level person named Jim Jones. I was his aide-de-camp when he was the U.S. European commander in SAC-UR, which is the NATO commander. I shadowed him. I went to every country in Europe, half the countries in Africa. And obviously, NATO was taking over the training mission in Iraq. We were taking over PRTs in Afghanistan. We were still busy in Kosovo and Bosnia. So we never were home in Belgium, where my ex-wife and at that point, three kids, because we had our third son. I was deployed 278 days out of the year for 2 years with General Jones. So it was a remarkable tour. And then I ran enlisted assignments and retention for the Marine Corps. And then I was stationed with him again at the State Department. I did a year-long deployment to the Middle East. I worked on the peace process between the Israelis and the Palestinians.
Yeah. So, which had to be this crazy challenging. If you look at what everything we're going through right now, oh my gosh, tell me a little bit about the challenges of that assignment.
Well, it's a funny story. I would say that the assignment with Jim Jones at NATO was the most rewarding and probably the duty station that set me up for the most success in leaving the military. The way I described the tour at the State Department when he was the special envoy for Middle East regional security under President Bush was I really was not a subject matter expert on the Middle East. I was actually sitting at my desk leading enlisted assignments, the monitors, and General Jones called me up. I mean, he was already out of the Marine Corps, called me up and said, would I like to be his MILSAC for this special role that he got? And I said, sir, I don't know anything about the Middle East. I'm exactly the wrong person. And he said, no, you're exactly the right person because you have no bias. So we're going to send you a bunch of books and materials to read, and I'd really like you to go. And even though General Jones and I spent a lot of time in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we were all over the world, I felt a little bit of an obligation because I didn't do a long tour duty like my brothers and sisters who spent 6 months or 9 months or a year or even 15 months with some army units in Iraq and Afghanistan. So, you know, I went home that night. I told my ex-wife and my three sons what I was doing. And 3 weeks later, on my son's birthday, my oldest son's birthday, my ex-wife drove me to the airport. I got on a plane. It was a really, really unique experience. I was in plain clothes all the time. We were attached to USAID. I would spend time at the embassy in Tel Aviv. I would spend time at the consulate in Jerusalem. I was going inside the West Bank. I got to go to Jordan. I got to go to Egypt. So, you know, all in all, I learned a heck of a lot about the region. I really have a deeper understanding as to why the discord exists, right? And this is born over centuries, and it's not something that I believe we would ever be able to bring peace to the region just based on centuries of deep-rooted hate. Like, I think there's a divide there that it's really hard to close. And there were lots of obstacles to that, but I learned a lot and I would never trade that experience. I remember coming back in October of 2008. So it was most of that year and we were getting ready to give a report to Condi Rice, to Secretary Rice. And I'm walking down the hallway with General Jones in the State Department. And he said, so where are you going next? And I said, what do you mean? Where am I going next? I'm getting out. And he's like, no way. I'm like, yeah. He called me later that afternoon after he went back to the chamber because he was working at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And he said, hey, I want you to come meet someone tomorrow at the chamber. I'm like, what's the chamber? So he told me. So I went over to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and I sat down with 90 Minutes with the president and CEO, Tom Donahue. And literally the next day or probably within the next week, I got an offer from Tom Donahue to be kind of his right-hand man. I used to call it the chief of staff on the road, but essentially I was made a vice president at the chamber. I was literally walking down the hallway again with General Jim Jones and Condi Rice for the final report. And the next day I was wearing a suit. I can't explain it. I'm wearing my alphas one day and a suit the next day, walking in the halls of the chamber. So, but I think all the things in my life, I had a very unique career, and I think I was very fortunate and blessed to have those tours because it basically has started assimilating me into a more of a civilian role before my peers. Like if you're at NATO and you're deploying to 50 countries with a high level general with heads of state, and then you're at the chamber and you're wearing a suit and you're going to all these meetings, you just in Israel and going there, it was just an easy transition for me.
Yeah, my time in the Middle East and in the deployable command and control, and then as a load master, went on to serve me very well at UPS. And when I find myself back in the Middle East in Dubai every 3 months, and know that I have to sit down and have tea with somebody and talk about the weather and talk about their family long before you'd ever talk about business.
It's funny because when we met, or when we talked in person in Atlanta the last time, I think a lot of the reason you, me, Tommy Jones, I think a lot of the reason we do this work is because we were fortunate and blessed to have these experiences that set us up for success in different ways. And we want to give back to our community. We want to help younger soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marine thrive in the work that they do afterwards.
Yeah, that motivates me. I mean, I spent so long in the business side of UPS, and you know, was making real money and getting bonuses and paying off my house and taking real vacations. But what motivated me was all that volunteering I was doing. When I would get a call, go, "Hey, that mock interview you did for me, it helped. I landed the job. Hey, you got me a mentor through America Corporate Partners. You got me a resume through Hire Heroes. Thanks. I mean, you changed my star." So I think the group of, I'm honored to be in, you mentioned in those names, because it's an amazing group, but absolutely. So I really want to dig into what you did at a couple things, actually three things. I want to dig into what you did at the chamber, because I think, wow, you changed the space on what would become Hiring Our Heroes. Then the insanity, the leave, like at the top of your game, I mean, like you became a legend and we're doing these big things and you stepped away, and what that painful transition looked like. And then what you're doing with your organization now, Zero Mills. So let's talk about so you got hired to be the vice president. You're the traveling chief of staff. How did that develop into what would eventually become the Hiring Our Heroes and everything with the SkillBridge program and the fellowships and everything like that?
It's a great question, because I can remember it like it was yesterday. It's great to reminisce about coming home from Desert Storm 35 years ago, and then Hiring Our Heroes was founded 15 years ago last week. So it's good timing on this, Lloyd. When I got to the chamber, basically think about shadowing someone for 2 years. It's the same thing as being an aide de camp. So I was with Tom Donahue at every meeting with every CEO, every internal meeting at the chamber, every trip that he went to India, China, Brazil, Colombia. So I got to see 40 more countries with Tom Donahue all over the world, and basically a crash course in what the business community prioritizes. So I'm sitting side by side with him at all these meetings with CEOs like Jamie Dimon, literally in front of Jamie Dimon's desk. And without exception, these CEOs, Tom would lead with a story about how I was shadowing him as a Marine. He used to have an active duty Marine for a year at a time. It was the first time he hired a retired Marine. And without exception, Lloyd, every single CEO, to include Jamie Dimon, would say, "We love veterans in our company. We want to hire more veterans." And when you do a job like that at the end of your 2 years, because that was my commitment, you always get asked what you want to do next. And when Tom asked me what I want to do next, I connected what happened to me when I was in charge of enlisted assignments, when I was talking to young Marines who were leaving the Marine Corps. We actually were responsible for re-enlisting Marines too. And we'd go around the world trying to get the top quarter of first termers, the top 25% to re-enlist. The other 75%, which we let go as a cycle, like the Marine Corps literally keeps a very young force. They had no earthly idea what they wanted to do next with their lives after leaving the military. So when Tom asked me, I said, "I think the U.S. Chamber of Commerce should take this one-day event that they do every year in November around Veterans Day called Hiring Our Heroes, where they have panels and keynotes, and turn that into a real employment program that helps solve a huge problem in 2011. Veteran unemployment was 10%. There were 1 million unemployed veterans who had come back from Iraq and Afghanistan. Veterans under the age of 24, the unemployment rate was 30%. So when I'm talking to Tom on this plane ride back from wherever we were in the United States, and I told him I want to do that, he said, "No, we're not doing that. We're not the Department of Labor. We're not the VA. We're not DOD. We're not the government."
Yeah, I said, "That's exactly right.
you're damn right, right?" I said, "No, we're just the largest business federation in the world. And we, the private sector, can solve this problem where the government can't. And we have a responsibility." So to Tom's credit, he allowed me to start the program. I actually had a second job that I had to do because the chamber wasn't bought in. I had an 8x8 office, no windows, no staff, no budget. And I just started going around the country one by one by one, doing large events, hiring fairs, which we know aren't not the best way to get people hired. But we created a movement and we had this incredible opportunity. I think it was like number 11, number 10 or 11, to work with Veterans on Wall Street in New York City. They were doing a networking event and a mentoring event on the USS Intrepid. And they had seen what I had done in Chicago and Hartford and all these other places. And they invited me out. The five banks invited me out. And we put up a tent outside the Intrepid, and we had 100 employers, 1,000 veterans come through that day. But we were covered by every network. We were like, and not just local networks in New York, the national networks. I was on MSNBC, CNBC. And then the word got out the very next month to stand up a hiring fair in Sony Studios in LA, where Prince William and Kate were visiting. And then we were covered by 100 networks, a reach of 1 billion people across the world, not just across America, but across the world. And a philanthropist in Minneapolis named Lee Anderson saw me on the news. He had a connection with Ambassador Nicholson, who was an advisor at the chamber. And I got a meeting with Lee Anderson and Ambassador Nicholson, Secretary Nicholson, some people know him as, who ran the VA, who had a close relationship with Tom. At the time, I wasn't allowed to raise money. I wasn't given that authority. I would raise money locally just to cover the cost of the events. So I came with a deck, even though I wasn't allowed to raise money. And at the end of the meeting, Lee Anderson committed $3 million. And then something really big happened. So in the start of Hiring Our Heroes, I went to 25 of the biggest employers in America. And I said, hey, we're going to do all these events. I just want you to come and be part of it and hire veterans. So after I went home to DC and I told Tom that we raised $3 million, he said, okay, well, now you can go after this because you have the resources. I hired 7 people, Ross Cohen, Laura Dempsey, now Laura Schmiegel, my wife, Noreen O'Neill, Brian Gettle, Kathy Poynton, and Zoe Rand, who was my EA. And they were the core founding team in my mind. Because we had only done 12 and I had committed to doing 100 in a year and we were already 6 months in. So we hired a team and I reached out to the 25 companies. And within 9 days, I had asked them to join this Veterans Employment Advisory Council, which still exists today. Within 9 days, we raised $1.8 million more capital, and then we could grow our team more. We could host bigger events. We could go after it. And then it just built momentum. We created resume engines for both veterans and military spouses that Toyota sponsored. Capital One committed to a big campaign called Hiring 500,000 Heroes. They dedicated $4.5 million in capital. The Cohen family, who had a son who was a Marine, it was just rapid growth, and our team grew to 30 people in the first year. And we committed to those 100 events. We did them. The next year, we did 400 events. But at the same time, we were building some of the same programs. Like, we had a program called Fast Track, which mapped BLS data and showed where the next skills gaps were going to be and where young veterans should be considering going to work to get high-paying jobs. And we just grew it. And I guess I'm a builder and a starter, but to be honest, those were probably the busiest 3 years of my life. I worked 80 or 90 hours a week. And the same story that you told, Lloyd, at that very first hiring fair in Chicago on March 24th of 2011, a young Marine sergeant who was 23 came up to me and said, sir, you changed my life today. I got a job. And I went in the corner and I was bawling. I was bawling. I called my ex-wife and my kids and I said, I did it. I did it. Like, we changed someone's life. And it's like this addiction. Like especially with a job, when you help someone get a job, when you help them find their purpose again, this kid had been out of work for a year. He was an infantryman in the United States Marine Corps, had deployed to theater, right? Fought for our country. And everyone told him he could only be a security guard. And he just wouldn't do it. And he got a great job that day with Aon. And, you know, I never met the kid again because we were doing big things, trying to create a movement. This was the military-friendly movement. And to be honest, I worked myself to the point of a nervous breakdown. I was exhausted physically, mentally, emotionally. I was essentially deployed for my kids. I was on the road 180 days at hiring events, at networking events, with presidents, with heads of state like William and Kate. Like, so I burned myself out completely and I left in the summer of 2013. I don't know, end of July, beginning of August. In some ways to try to save my first marriage, to get reconnected with my kids. And it was the worst thing I ever did.
I was going to ask you, what knowing now, you know a lot more now, right? What would you do differently if you could live that over again? And I know it's a BS question, but I'm just curious, what would you do?
Yeah. I go back to the first part of being a Catholic and believing everything happens for a reason and we're fated. I think to myself that I did what I'm really good at, which is building and growing things very quickly and then handing it off for someone to sustain it and to grow it more modestly and put other programs. Like, I didn't create the Skillbridge program. I didn't create the fellowship program. And I think there are a lot of great programs that Hiring Our Heroes implemented. Honestly, if I could do it again, I wouldn't have had a lapse of purpose. I would have immediately got the rest I needed and then gone to another nonprofit and grew it and built it and scaled it because I needed purpose-driven work. So I took about 4 or 5 months off and I went back to the chamber. They were very gracious. They gave me a job as a vice president of development. But I was gone. I mean, I was lost. I had no purpose. I had no connection to my community. I isolated myself. I wasn't sleeping again. I was self-medicating. I wasn't seeking self-improvement. So when you say, what would I do again? I think it was inevitable that I had to leave. The chamber offered me a black car to come pick me up in Fredericksburg, like flying first class on planes, staying in the best hotels, like getting an apartment in DC, but I was running a nonprofit. Like, I wasn't going to really discredit the community that I helped build, the military and veteran nonprofit community. And listen, if you look at some of the 990s that exist right now, and you look at some of the salaries that people get paid and the revenue that nonprofits are getting and the lack of like lower level people that are getting taken care of in those organizations, I don't consider them nonprofits anymore. Like, I don't think of it that way, but I got out of Hiring Our Heroes for the right reasons at the right time. What I do regret is taking a job where I got paid a lot more money, was working less time, and lost everything that helped me thrive, which is part of the reason really that Zero Mills exists now.
So you struggled mightily. How did you pull yourself out of it?
I struggled for 4 years mightily.
Yeah.
I wound up getting divorced. I moved out of the house, felt guilty because I left my ex-wife and my 3 kids, lived up in an apartment by myself, still did that job. And one day in 2016, so this is 3 years later, I got an invite from a Marine veteran, a Vietnam veteran named Buzz Hefty, who was good friends with General Jones. They knew each other from their service in Vietnam. He asked me to go to a Capitals game on behalf of the Tragedy Assistance Program for Survivors, Bonnie Carroll's organization. Every year, the Capitals host this event where we're VIPs, veterans who come, and they give you this hat when you walk in. It's called a courage cap. And, you know, it's a baseball cap that has the word courage on it. Anyway, when I'm at that event, Buzz Hefty sees me across the room. He comes up to me and said, "Hey, what's bothering you?" I'm like, "Oh, nothing's bothering me. Nothing's bothering me, Buzz." He's like, "No, what's wrong?" So I was sharing with him the struggles I was having. And he said, "Well, that's easy. Just go back to nonprofit work." Literally, that's what he said to me. He didn't make a big deal about it, just very, very matter of fact. I go to my net desk the next day at the chamber. I'm sitting there, the courage cap sitting in the very corner. And literally that afternoon, my phone rings and it's Korn Ferry. Kate Kohler is on the other line. And they're headhunting someone for a job with an organization called Thanks USA, a small scholarship foundation for military spouses and kids, post-secondary need-based scholarships. I had an interview the next week. I had an offer the next day. And, you know, 2-3 weeks later, I was the president of Thanks USA. It was a small organization. I grew it from 300 scholarships a year to 1,000. I did that for a year and a half. But I was still struggling. Like, I didn't feel fulfilled. Started getting the right treatment. Started feeling better. Had Laura in my life. Like, she's my soulmate. We share not everything, just everything in life, but we share everything in our work, like our passion. She started Blue Star Family. She was part of Hiring Our Heroes. We found each other again and we wound up getting engaged, getting married. So everything was moving in the right direction. And then I got a call from a West Coast headhunter who got me the job with Operation Gratitude. And I did that for 4 years. And that was a big job. We had 1 million volunteers across the country. It was largely based in California. With like remote volunteers, we started scaling to doing service projects in other communities. And we went from a $10 million organization to $23 million in 3.5 years that I was the CEO. Our team grew from 13 to 37, largely veterans and military spouses. We grew our impact from 250,000 deployed troops and veterans every year to 620,000 deployed troops, veterans, first responders, doctors, and nurses. We got through COVID and we were a hands-on volunteer organization. So I think of it as tour of duties, like 3 years, I go in, I address a problem that I think our community needs to address. And then I go on to the next thing.
And then your next thing is Zero Mills. So the, was that it? Like I get these great ideas sometimes that just come out of the blue. Was that one of those ideas, or was that one that developed over time and you always had it in your hip pocket and wanted to build it?
There's two answers to the question. One, the idea was born in response to growing trends that we saw in the private sector with nonprofits that paint the broken veteran narrative, elicit sympathy and pity to raise money. And we just got sick and tired of it. I got sick and tired of it. And I think this is the greatest threat to the veteran community and our families, is the broken veteran narrative. So we started Zero Mills because we also got sick of nonprofits competing with each other and not working together to create greater change. We saw this whole idea of military friendliness, not just as blah and passe. We saw it as disrespectful. Like, I think being military friendly for a company is a good foundation. I wouldn't use the word disrespectful as much as like, okay, well, that's ordinary. And the attraction of veterans to fill jobs is something that we've solved for. So we saw this opportunity to create a company that creates extraordinary cultures and communities. And that's the second part of the question. We did not coin the phrase military thriving until I think we were at the year mark we started talking about it. It was Paul that started using the word thriving. And I was literally driving to my son's wedding with Laura from DC to Fredericksburg. And I called my team and I said, this is it. And I wrote down these five things: meaningful employment, purpose, a sense of purpose through continued service, connected community or tribe, health and well-being, physical, mental, spiritual, emotional, and the kit bag, constantly seeking self-improvement, education, training, certification, being a mentor, being a mentee. Lloyd, those are the things that we had in the military. We had those five things. We were thriving. It's the most thriving time in my life. Paul and I had that together. Zero Mills was not born because we were successful entrepreneurs and we were these people that said, thriving is it. It was born out of pain, suffering, mental illness, depression, knowing that we lacked those five things in our lives, right? And when I was at an all-time high, I lifted Paul out. When I was at an all-time low, Paul lifted me up. That's what the veteran community can do together. That's what we do every day for each other. We don't need government, nonprofits, corporations to do that. We are thriving as a result of our service and not in spite of it.
Well, I really want to dig in what you were saying about the nonprofits. And it's I started Ventlanta with John Phillips 14 years ago. I was naive, and that naiveness created something very special. But the nonprofits that were out there beat us up. They all saw us as a threat. And some of the big ones, and I won't get nasty in name of the names, the one that was sold a lot of T-shirts and had a lot of people doing celebrities doing commercials, but were so threatened about us, they would disparage us and trash us on social media. And then the crazy thing is, Atlanta's not even a nonprofit. We're a club, and our charter says we can never take any money or give any money. We were there to connect the dots, to connect those nonprofits with the clients, because they all have trouble finding clients, and then connect them with donors and volunteers, and connect them with our companies, because we were started from the who's who of Fortune 100 companies in Atlanta. And I saw so much nastiness along the way. And then when they finally started trusting us, they wouldn't work together. And I was like, you guys do something totally different. You need to complement each other, because all of us are in here for the same reason. We're here to help veterans and their families. And we all agree with that.
it's something that we have to all think about as a community too, because we decide who we work for, we decide where we live and run our small businesses, and we decide where we give our time, talent, and treasure to. So we say all the time, if a nonprofit is espousing the broken veteran narrative and you don't agree with that, you don't have to give them your time, your talent, or your treasure. I think people need to do a deeper dive on the word nonprofit, and it's a misnomer. We use for purpose, for impact. And it's a frustration point for me, because we could have started Zero Mills as a nonprofit. It's a service disabled veteran owned small business, social impact advisory firm that is all about getting people to work together to make greater change for cultures and communities. And listen, the same disparagement, pot shots, people saying, be careful. I'm not being careful. I know I was a nonprofit leader for 10 years. I saw the greatest of despair, and I am one of the only people that can do what I'm doing and say what I'm saying, and I'm going to say it, and I'm going to shout it from the rooftops. So in very simple terms, there is a disparity, and there is unfair access for nonprofits with government agencies, because there's something bad about a for-profit. I will tell you this. I'm not going to say which nonprofits. I'm not going to go. I believe nonprofits that are running large organizations and they reach a certain amount of revenue, their employees should be paid well. All the way from top to bottom. I will tell you this. At Zero Mills, and this is true, I make 1/7 or 1/8 of what the current leader of one of the nonprofits I led is making, and 1/4 of what I made at another one of the nonprofits that I led, and about half of what I made at Thanks USA. So at the end of the day, I chose to do this because I wanted organizations to work together. If I had made Zero Mills and Military Thriving a .org, everyone would think that I was competing with them. And that is not what I wanted to do. I want everyone to work together. So there is this misperception that a nonprofit doesn't have to make a profit. And they do. They do in order to grow the impact that they're making. So what I would encourage everyone to do that's watching this is to do their due diligence, to look at a 990, to actually go into a financial statement and make decisions about how they're going to invest their money based on what they would if they were to invest in a stock for a company. It's the same thing. And the last thing I'll say is measure. What are people measuring? What do they say? Like, look at their social media posts. Look at what they're saying about the impact that they're making. Because you know, I've been to Atlanta events before. I've been invited to them when I was at Operation Gratitude. You guys had me out there. It's one of the most impactful events at a local level that anyone's making. So why is that being disparaged? Or why is any for-profit company that gives services completely free to veterans being disparaged too, or not getting access that a nonprofit has in a certain right. community? It makes no sense at all.
I'm glad you're out there. I love to see you out there. Some people don't like her, but the Elizabeth Hartman, what she's doing, and if you follow her on LinkedIn, if you don't, take a look. That kind of stuff is kind of needed. Some checks and balances that haven't been there before.
I think everyone has the ability to dive deeper. I think companies have a responsibility. They call it corporate social responsibility. I think companies have a responsibility to dive deeper too and to look at these things as well. I was born as a Marine. The first half of my professional career was spent in the government. I was a nonprofit leader for 10 years, and I know a lot about that space. And now I am a proud veteran small business owner, a social impact entrepreneur. I've helped 17 nonprofits raise $60 million in new revenue since I started Zero Mills. And arguably, Lloyd, I'm making just as much, if not more, of an impact on our community doing what I'm doing now than I did at Hiring Our Heroes, that I did at Thanks USA, and that I did at Operation Gratitude.
Yeah, I believe it. And then what I'm always amazed is what some of these smaller organizations, and you know, to being a fellow Bush Scholar, you've been around that, to see, wow, what these smaller organizations that people are doing with $100,000, like, right? And I was like, oh my gosh, look what you did. But why can't we get you $1 million? Like, why do the $1 million always have to go to the big guys who are that $1 million having a less impact?
I want to say thank you for teeing me up to tell you what I felt at the Presidential Leadership Scholars. And I've helped VLPers like Veronese Castillo, like Harrison Bernstein, realize their full potential. And what Veronese has done at the Military Spouse Advocacy Network, what Harrison has done at Soldiers to Sidelines, is what I want to do with the rest of my life too, outside of Zero Mills. So when I left PLS, I saw leaders just like Veronese and Harrison and Lydia, who went through the VLP program too. And I'm thinking to myself, how do I empower these leaders to grow, just like I did with Veronese and Harrison? And with Laura's help, because she helps me with just about everything, I created a 10-week curriculum for emerging nonprofit leaders. And I rolled out a program called the Service Project, and I'm going to be working with some pretty serious partners and funders to get nonprofit leaders who are the Davids compared to these Goliaths. And I'm going to prop them up, shine a spotlight on them with the Service Project. And I'm going to teach them everything that I know, everything that I learned experientially at Hiring Our Heroes, Thanks USA, and Operation Granite. Not what you learn at a four-year institution or when you're getting your master's in nonprofit management. No, like, how do you grow your organization with the private sector in mind, with value and return on investment? How are you the chief storyteller? How do you run an organization with a vision that executes on the grassroots level and empower your team? Listen, this has to be done. At this point in our community, there are big nonprofits out there that are literally disparaging the smaller ones, saying that they should consolidate, saying they should be merged, acquired, or they should go away, or they want to subsume them and grow into these bigger Goliaths. And you know what? That's just plain wrong. So in the process, if there is a nonprofit leader that comes to me and I think they should consider a merger or an acquisition, I will tell them straight up, hey, I think that there's a great organization doing this. You may want to consider doing it. But I will never discourage a Veronese or a Harrison or a Lydia or any leader that you met at VLP or I met at PLS. I will never discourage them because they are the next big idea. And they are catching every single person that's falling through the cracks at the local level that the big ones are not addressing because they're too busy at podiums and at panels and at big conferences and symposiums talking about the problems instead of being in the community and getting stuff done. Amen. That's the difference.
Yeah. I'm loving it. So absolutely loving it. If I didn't have more work to do at UPS in Bethlehem, I would jump right on and say, hire me, Kevin. But God's got a plan for me. So,
well, I appreciate what you're doing and giving me this opportunity to talk. Like I was saying to you in Atlanta when we met at the Military Influencer Conference, it's funny that we've been in this space for so long and that God kind of intersects us at different times. And we've been looking for a time to do this podcast together. And listen, I'm at the point in my life, I'm 58 and I want to make a difference. I'm impatient. And it's funny at PLS, and you probably did this exercise at VLP, we did this thing based on Jim Collins' book, Good to Great. And we drew these three circles on a piece of paper and we said, what brings me joy? What am I good at? And what does my community need from me? Right? That's Zero Mills and that's the Service Project. And I'm just going to create this perfect Venn diagram and do those three things. And that's what you're doing.
Yeah, well, I appreciate it. So love it. Love that, that we're intersecting together and man, we're gonna help a lot of veterans. So we got some runway in front of
our dog Jake wants to be on your podcast too. So
love that. So my friend, what advice can you offer? Let's give you an opportunity for two: a veteran that's getting ready to transition, and then a nonprofit that's struggling.
Yeah. So I'll say for the veteran, the service member, the spouse, anyone that's looking to transition wherever they are in their life, we're always in transition. I had 7 jobs as a Marine, 7 duty stations. I've had 7 jobs since I left the Marine Corps. Ask yourself those three questions. What brings me joy? What's my purpose? What am I good at? And how can I make money or make a difference? What does my community need from me? And if you ask yourself those three questions in transition, all the other things that you're getting at TAP, great. Like, take them on board, but ask yourself those three questions and demand that you answer it and try to create your own Venn diagram. At the same time, ask yourself in transition, demand of yourself, don't ask yourself, demand of yourself that you get those 5 things: meaningful employment, a sense of purpose, connection and tribe, good health, and fill your kit bag up with those things you need to constantly seek self-improvement. If you answer those three questions, you demand those 5 things of the employer that you work with, of yourself, you're going to thrive. And that's all I want for them. And they can do it as long as they ask those three questions and demand those five things. And what was the second question?
A nonprofit that's struggling.
A nonprofit that I would love for them to work with.
Yeah. Well, they're out there.
They're struggling. So I'm going to answer that question a little bit different. If they're struggling, they can reach out to me in any of these five areas: meaningful employment, purpose through service, connection, tribe, health, and kickback. And I think there are excellent examples of all those. If you look at the purpose one, sense of purpose, connection, tribe, health, Soldiers and Sidelines is a great one. Travis Mannion Foundation, Team RWB, Team Rubicon. I'm all about the ones that are painting the picture about our community, showing us as champions, like as leaders. Like if you think about the organizations I just named, Soldiers and Sidelines, Travis Mannion Foundation, Team Rubicon, Team RWB, are they talking about broken veterans? We're on the move. We're going after it, right? So that would be my suggestion, is find the organizations. And if anyone out there is listening, is struggling to find that one in those buckets, those five buckets, all they have to do is message me on LinkedIn and I will answer them within 24 hours.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Kevin. This has been a blast. I can't wait that we have an opportunity to break bread together. So maybe at the Military Influencers Conference in Tampa. So it's great.
I'll be there.
Spend time with you. And for my listeners, we'll close it like we always do. Be like Kevin, be safe, be kind, and be remarkable.
The Tango Tango podcast is proudly sponsored by Supply Chain Now. Join the Tango Tango community for more inspiring stories. Follow us on Facebook, X, and LinkedIn. Subscribe to the Tango Tango YouTube channel. And follow and listen to Tango Tango wherever you get your podcasts.